Winter, 1934. Beginning, August 1920. As summer wheat came ripe, so did I, born at home on the kitchen floor. Ma crouched, barefoot, bare-bottomed over the swept boards, because that's where Daddy said it'd be best. I came too fast for the doctor, bawling as soon as Daddy wiped his hand around inside my mouth. To hear Ma tell it, I hollered myself red the day I was born. Red's the color I've stayed ever since. Daddy named me Billy Joe. He wanted a boy. Instead, he got a long-legged girl with a wide mouth and cheekbones like bicycle handles. He got a red-headed, freckle-faced, narrow-hipped girl with a fondness for apples and a hunger for playing fierce piano. From the earliest I can remember, I've been restless in this little panhandle shack we call home, always getting in Ma's way with my pointy elbows, my fidgety legs. By the summer I turned 9, Daddy had given up about having a boy. He tried making me do. I look just like him. I can handle myself most everywhere he puts me, even on the tractor, though I don't like that much. Ma tried having other babies. It never seemed to go right except with me. But this morning, Ma led on as how she's expecting again. Other than the 3 of us, there's not much family to speak of. Daddy, the only boy Kelby left since Grandpa died from a cancer that ate up the most of his skin, and Aunt Ellis, almost 14 years older than Daddy, and living in Lubbock, away south of here and a whole world apart to hear Daddy tell it. And Ma, with only Great Uncle Floyd, old as ancient Indian bones and mean as a rattler, rotting away in that room down in Dallas. I'll be nearly 14, just like Aunt Ellis was when Daddy was born by the time this baby comes. Wonder if Daddy'll get his boy this time. January, 1934. Rabbit battles. Mr. Noble and Mr. Romney have a bet going as to who can kill the most rabbits. It all started at the rabbit drive last Monday over to Sturgis when Mr. Noble got himself worked up about the damage done to his crop by jacks. Mr. Romney swore he'd had more rabbit trouble than anyone in Cimarron County. They pledged revenge on the rabbit population, wagering who could kill more. They ought to just shut up, betting on how many rabbits they can kill. Honestly, grown men clubbing bunnies to death makes me sick to my stomach. I know rabbits eat what they shouldn't, especially this time of year when they could hop halfway to Liberal and still not find food. But Miss Freeland says, if we keep plowing under the stuff they ought to be eating, what are they supposed to do? Mr. Noble and Mr. Romney came home from Sturgis Monday with 20 rabbits apiece, a tie. It should have stopped there, but Mr. Romney wasn't satisfied. He said, Noble cheated. He brought in rabbits somebody else killed. And so the contest goes on. Those men, they used to be best friends. Now they can't be civil with each other. They scowl as they pass on the street. I'm scowling too, but scowling won't bring the rabbits back. They're all skinned and cooked and eaten by now. At least they didn't end up in Romney and Noble's cook pots. They went to families that needed the meat. January, 1934. Losing Livy. Livy Killian moved away. I didn't want her to go. We'd been friends since first grade. The farewell party was Thursday night at the old rock schoolhouse. Livy had something to tease each of us about, like Ray sleeping through reading class, and Hillary, who on her speed writing test put an even ton of children instead of an even 10. Livy said goodbye to each of us separately. She gave me a picture she'd made of me sitting in front of a piano, wearing my straw hat, an apple halfway to my mouth. I handed Livy the memory book we'd all filled with our different slants. I couldn't get the muscles in my throat relaxed enough to tell her how much I'd miss her. Livy helped clean up her own party, wiping spilled lemonade, gathering sandwich crusts, sweeping cookie crumbs from the floor, while the rest of us went home to study for semester reviews. Now, Livy's gone west, out of the dust on her way to California, where the wind takes a rest sometimes. And I'm wondering what kind of friend I am, wanting my feet on that road to another place instead of Livy's. January, 1934. Me and Mad Dog. Arlie Wonderdale, who teaches music once a week at our school, though Ma says he's no teacher at all, just a local song plugger. Arlie Wonderdale asked if I'd like to play a piano solo at the Palace Theater on Wednesday night. I grinned, pleased to be asked, and said, "That'd be all right." I didn't know if Ma would let me. She's an old mule on the subject of my schooling. She says, "You stay home on weeknights, Billy Joe." And mostly that's what I do. But Arlie Wonderdale said, "The management asked me to bring them talent, Billy Joe, and I thought of you." Even before Mad Dog Craddock, I wondered. "You and Mad Dog," Arlie Wonderdale said. Darn that blue-eyed boy with his fine face and his smooth voice. Twice as good as a plowboy has any right to be. I suspected Mad Dog had come first to Arlie Wonderdale's mind, but I didn't get too riled. Not so riled I couldn't say yes. January 1934. Permission to play. Sometimes, when Ma is busy in the kitchen or scrubbing or doing wash, I can ask her something in such a way I annoy her just enough to get an answer, but not so much I get a no. That's a way I've found of gaining what I want, by catching Ma off guard, especially when I'm after permission to play piano. Right out asking her is no good. She always gets testy about me playing, even though she's the one who truly taught me. Anyway, this time, I caught her in the slow stirring of biscuits, her mind on other things. Maybe the baby growing inside her, I don't know. But anyhow, she was distracted enough. I was determined enough. This time, I got just what I wanted. Permission to play at the Palace. January 1934. On stage. When I point my fingers at the keys, the music springs straight out of me. Right hand, playing notes sharp as tongues, telling stories while the smooth, buttery rhythms back me up on the left. Folks sway in the palace aisles, grinning and stomping and out of breath. And the rest, eyes shining, fingers snapping, feet tapping. It's the best I've ever felt, playing hot piano, sizzling with Mad Dog, swinging with the Black Mesa boys, or on my own, crazy, pestering the keys. That is heaven. How supremely heaven playing piano can be. January 1934. Birthday for FDR. I played so well on Wednesday night, Arlie put his arm across my shoulder and asked me to come and perform at the president's birthday ball. Ma can't say no to this one. It's for President Roosevelt. Not that Mr. Roosevelt will actually be there, but the money collected at the ball, along with balls all over the country, will go in the president's name to the Warm Springs Foundation, where Mr. Roosevelt stayed once when he was sick. Someday, I plan to play for President Franklin Delano Roosevelt himself. Maybe I'll go all the way to the White House in Washington, D.C. In the meantime, it's pretty nice Arlie asking me to play twice for Joy City. January 1934. Not too much to ask. We haven't had a good crop in 3 years, not since the bounty of 31. And we're all whittled down to the bone these days, even Ma with her new round belly. But still, when the committee came asking, Ma donated 3 jars of applesauce and some cured pork, and a feed sack 90 she'd sewn for our coming baby. February 1934.